Radha Agrawal is an absolute force of nature. She's the founder of Daybreaker, which is the largest and most powerful ecstatic dance community that I've ever become aware of. And I love ecstatic dance. For anybody who's been to any of our Fit for Service events, it's always a part of it. So we talk about that, community building, her new maps for consciousness, all kinds of interesting things on this podcast. I hope you enjoy it with Radha Agrawal.
But before we get started, a word from our sponsors.
First up, we have Mudwater. So we at the show have been drinking Mudwater for years. And there's a reason. It's an incredible company with an incredible product and now a wider range of products. So not only do they have their Rise Cacao, which is originally like a coffee alternative, because if you guys read my book, Own the Day, you realize I don't have coffee until the afternoon. I don't like to wake up with coffee. I like to allow myself to wake up, get a little sun, get some water, get some exercise. But Mudwater is perfect for that first morning drink. I blend it with some fats. I blend it with some protein. So the Rise Cacao has been a part of my regimen for a long time. But I've started to add their turmeric version midday and even their evening Mudwater later at night. And not only is it packed with the best nutrients and functional mushrooms that you're looking for, not only does it have great taste and not a bunch of bullshit sweetener. If you want to sweeten it, you can sweeten it yourself. It provides either that natural energy or relaxation, depending on which blend you're using. But it's just all quality ingredients, 100% certified organic, non-GMO, gluten-free, vegan. It's even fucking kosher. Mudwater is one of the best companies around, one of the best products around. I know the founder, and I really can't more highly recommend Mudwater. They donate monthly to support psychedelic research and have done so since day one. Mudwater, these are our people, y'all, and let's support our people. Please go support these guys. They've been one of the biggest supporters of the show, and again, I can't more strongly stress that this is just something that's going to be super additive to your life. You're really going to enjoy it. I know you will because I know how much I enjoy it. So if you go to mudwtr.com/amp, you'll get a bunch of samples and the frother, which is also super helpful because it allows you to blend these on the go, like really fast. So you'll get all the samples and the frother for free. So go to mudwtr.com/amp, get your samples, get your frother, and you'll be supporting the show. Thanks so much, y'all. Next up, we have Soltara Healing Center. So if you've heard me talk about my ayahuasca experiences over the last 3 years, or perhaps saw the documentary Dragon of the Jungle, you've heard me talk about Soltara Healing Center. This is the place that I've gone, and this is the place that I'll continue to go for the foreseeable future because of a few reasons. One, I trust the integrity of the leadership. I trust the integrity, quality, and impeccability of the facilitation, and also the selection of the shamans that they use to serve the medicine. In addition, their medicine that they use, the ayahuasca that they use, is a beautiful medicine. So many things come together to create a great healing center, and Soltara is a great healing center. And I've gone to their center in Costa Rica, and it's a beautiful place and is often booked out. So they've opened up some additional centers. They've opened up a center in Tarapoto. And more interestingly for me, they've opened a center in the Sacred Valley in Peru as well. Now, the Sacred Valley is absolutely gorgeous. It's one of the most beautiful places on the planet. And this facility is called Raíces Incas. And I'm really excited to check it out. I'll be there in May for my own private retreat. And I just really stand by Soltara being a super high quality operation from top to bottom. Now, as I'm talking about this, this is not me recommending that you go do ayahuasca. I want to make that very clear. The call to do ayahuasca is a very personal calling. It's a very personal choice to follow that medicine path. And I'm the last person to say that this is something that you should do. But if this is something that calls to you, I can stand by the fact that Soltara does it as well as any place that I've ever been to and really epitomizes excellence all the way top to bottom, from the food that they serve to the preparation to the integration to the facilitation. So I stand by Soltara as a company, as a facility, as a retreat center. And it's up to you whether this path calls to you.
But if it does, I think Soltara is a great choice. And it's really the only choice that I recommend to people who are interested in following the ayahuasca path. So once again, this is completely up to you, your own vocation, your own calling, your own choice. But if you do want to make the choice, I can say without hesitation that Soltara is an incredible facility and company to work with. So if you're interested in checking it out and checking out their new facility, Raíces Inca in the Sacred Valley, go to soltara.co. That's soltara.co. And I look forward to hearing how it goes for you. So I'm thrilled to share with you guys, I co-founded a new company called Sayu, which makes essential oils. And the reason I wanted to do this is that I've found that the power of essential oils when used in ceremony or in ordinary life is really profound. It's an opportunity to invite you into a different world. So when I'm facilitating medicine or receiving medicine, I reach for these essential oils to allow their scent to transport me into a different world. Now, there are many different botanicals and essential oils that exist in the market, but I wanted to create the very best, the things that I would want to use when I'm in ceremony, the worlds that I would want to enter into. And so we got with the best formulators, the best ingredient suppliers, where everything is sourced in a beautiful way, all the way from the seed to the distillation to the partners where we're acquiring these botanicals, so many of them wild harvested, so many of them that really abide by the principles of a more beautiful world and a more beautiful relationship with the world. And the name Sayu is also really rad. I asked Matthias DiStefano, what is the word in Atlantean for earth? And he scribbles on his notepad in Atlantean, so he really knows this language. And if you believe that or not, it's up to you. But he said the name was Sayu, S-A-Y-U. And so we called the company Sayu, S-A-Y-U, because it's a relationship with the beautiful array of flora that exists on our planet. So we created six different blends that invite you into six different worlds. The first world, of course, is Arcadia, the name of our festival. It's a scent that brings you this feeling of joy and connection in this unique blend called Arcadia. And then there's Valhalla, the smell of steel and leather, a more masculine scent, and the smell of the earth and wood. And then there's Eros, which is this delicious smell of both vanilla and spice that invites you into a more erotic state. And then there's Elysium, just like the heavenly fields that bring a sense of peace and calm. And then there's Mage, which was actually channeled by one of our partners as a way to use these unique plants that I've never smelled before as a form of spiritual protection and transportation into different worlds. And lastly, there's Helios, which uses the flower Corsican Helichrysum, which is one of the most coveted and beautiful scents in the world. And when I first smelled it, I was like, oh man, this is the smell of sunlight. If sunlight had a smell, this is it. So we called it Helios and blended it with some other botanicals. So everything from the beautiful packaging to the way that these oils are harvested and distilled from these plants, we just did it right every way, all the way up, all the way down. And these are all in my medicine bag wherever I go. And I think you guys are gonna love them. So I'm super proud to share our new company, Sayu.earth, Sayu.earth. And if you're interested, you can get 15% off with the code Aubrey and invite yourself into these wild, beautiful worlds that I've co-created with my partner, Carly. So Sayu.earth, and definitely let me know what you think, because I absolutely fucking love these essential oils.
And now an uninterrupted podcast with Radha Agrawal. Radha, here we are.
We are here.
Let's go. We've had some cool experiences together out cruising around Egypt. Thank you for organizing that unbelievable trip. And for anyone who wants to hear about that trip, you can listen to my podcast with Makad, which was absolutely mind-blowing. But that was all because you arranged something magical that we could come on board. So first of all, thanks for that.
Of course. I'll never forget that experience.
Yeah. And also, thank you for democratizing and popularizing one of my favorite
technologies in the world, which is ecstatic dance.
Yes.
It's so big. It's so important. It's such a big deal. It's like the core, it's one of the core central pillars of Fit for Service because it's one of the most radically transformational and medicinal experiences that we can have. It reminds us why we want to be alive. It breaks through the boundaries and constrictions that we have. It connects us. But what drew you? How did you, you know, because you run Daybreaker, and so I want you to tell us about that. But like, how did you find your way on that path? Where did it come to you?
Yeah, so for me, it was something I was always kind of ashamed of. How do I look on the dance floor? Am I going to look silly? So for a long time, actually, being from an Asian household, my mother's Japanese, my father's from India. Asians don't always sort of, it's not really part of the Asian culture, Japanese culture anyway.
I don't know. I've seen some Asians on Dance Dance Revolution.
Yes.
And they crush it.
As a discipline or as a choreographed experience, the Japanese are the best. But when it comes to freeform dancing, trust me, we opened Daybreaker in Tokyo and it was a wild experience going there. And just like it's a culture that's, I wouldn't say kind of self-expressed necessarily. Mm-hmm. It's a very disciplined, very honorable, very ritualized culture and community. Anyway.
Almost the language. I think there's a correlation between also the language and also the way that people's like psychic constructs are. Like Japanese has a very distinct language.
Yes, yes, staccato. Yes.
You know?
Totally. Yeah, I think for me, dance really came from, you know, sort of several areas, but the first was going to Burning Man in 2012, actually. I've always loved dance. I owned a nightclub in New York, you know, one of the hottest nightclubs in New York, and was an investor in it. And so I brought all my friends, you know, every Saturday night, but it wasn't the same kind of dance. You talk about ecstatic dance, right? Dance as a technology, dance as a healing, celebratory technology. I never really saw it as that. I always saw it as sort of a party place, right? It was something that you would do. You would let your hair down and just kind of go on a bender, you know, and that's really where dance was for me, even if my lineage of, you know, in Indian Bharatanatyam dance or Japanese, sort of that kind of very, that staccato sort of formal dance has been a part of my lineage. But, you know, being raised in America, you know, sort of you're part of the frat party scene, you go out at night and it's sort of this wild, wild experience. And so I think for me, going to Burning Man was the first time that two things happened, that I understood what it meant to be in my feminine power. I had been sort of really focused on my mask. I was an investment banker at a college, you know, on Wall Street. And I really kind of wanted to be seen as a hard-hitting entrepreneur. And so I was just deeply in my masculine and just wanting to just be one of the boys all the time. And going to Burning Man for me was this beautiful kind of rebirth and new expression for, wow, actually look at all these badass powerful women who are walking around in their feminine power. And I'd never seen those two words together before. So that was the first thing, was just like really understanding what it meant to be leaning into the feminine power. That was the first. And then the second was sober dance. And I'll never forget, I didn't know a single person. Now I go to Burning Man, everyone. But it's like when I first went 2012, I didn't know a single person except for my RV. It was five of us. We called the RV Boom Spiral, the opposite of Doom Spiral. Mm-hmm. And in this RV, there were just five of my friends and my twin sister included. But I'll never forget one night when everyone was sleeping. It was like 3-4 o'clock in the morning. And I was like, you know, I'm going to go out by myself for the first time, literally in my life. And I'm going to go out to Deep Playa and just kind of explore my bicycle by myself, sober. So I roll around alone and I'm like, wow, this is kind of weird. You know, I'm usually traveling with a crew or a posse or my twin. And I get to this robot heart bus, which obviously, you know, in this moment, it's like, okay, everyone's gone there. But for me, back then, I never heard of it. I didn't know what it was. So I just sort of threw my bike down and got into my body for the first time and just let the massive bass coming off the bus just enter my cellular system. And all of a sudden, I had this just wild awakening in my body of just like, whoa, I remember I was crying. My eyes were closed and I was crying. because it was like I'd finally come home to my body, to music, to the technology and the medicine of dance. And it was this beautiful moment of self-discovery and this rediscovery of myself, mm-hmm. you know? And I remember when I opened my eyes and I blinked my eyes open, all of a sudden dawn was coming up and the sun mm-hmm. was rising. And I just started weeping. And it was just this like incredibly ecstatic moment where, you know, sort of obviously the circadian rhythms of our bodies begin to come alive and you feel the surge of energy with the sun. And I just remember having this magical experience with the morning. And that's what inspired Daybreaker. So I came home and I was like, why are these wildly spiritual experiences only relegated to these once a year festivals? Like, right. Why can't we bring them to our cities where we live every day? So that's sort of the experiment of Daybreaker. And I was like, can we actually create these transformational, spiritual, self-expressed, sober experiences with the sun in major metros where we're the most lonely and the most disassociated with our bodies? Mm-hmm. So that was the experiment in 2013, and it worked.
Did you think that it was going to work? Or did you think like, man, maybe nobody's going to be into this?
Yeah, totally.
It's pretty popular now, but 2013, it was that popular.
Oh, no, nobody had ever danced in the morning before, ever. It was just like—
Or ecstatic dance, really.
Yeah, no.
I mean, they might have found themselves in an ecstatic dancing situation.
But it was never in the morning, and it was never in the morning.
Or with the intention that that's what you were going
right, to do. Right. And so I think for us, it was— It was a hilarious morning. I'll never forget. It was December 10th, 2013. It was the first snowfall. I remember waking up that morning and I was like, oh shit, it's snowing. No one's coming. There's absolutely no chance anyone's showing up. But we had sold 250 tickets. So I was like, okay, you know, maybe my friends, like I had been throwing parties with Mickey at our apartment for years. And then my co-founder, Matt Breimer, he and I had also been just community building for fun, throwing these poetry parties and all kinds of like dinner soirees at our houses just for fun. So when we invited our friends to come to the first one, they were just like, and we're like, it's $25. It's not a free event. Our friends bought tickets. And so we were able to actually see how many people could come to the event. And so that first morning of snowfall, I was like, oh, shit, no one's coming. And so I look at Matt, I'm like, all right, I guess we would just set up this DJ booth and set up this decor and create this event in Union Square at coffee shop in Union Square. It's RIP, it's no longer there. We were there that morning at 5 o'clock, and then 6 o'clock comes around and all of a sudden 180 people show up. And it was just like, boom. And because we were so intentional about the initial invitations, Matt and I spent days debating who would be, we had built an Excel spreadsheet literally of like, who would be the ultimate FYF, like fuck yeah friend, who would say, all right, I'll try a sober weekday morning dance party in the middle of winter, you know? And so, I call it FYF because it's like, you know, I think all of us are fuck yeah friends. We're like, Aubrey, we're going to this Egypt boat thing. You're like, mm-hmm. fuck yeah, I'm going, mm-hmm. you know? And this concept of FYF to me has really been a thread for community building, community architecture in general.
Yeah.
So we put a list of 300 FYFs and invited them, and 250 bought tickets, and 180 showed up to the very first one. And so I really feel like the energy of Daybreaker is what it is today because of the intentionality with which we kind of organized the energetics of the first event.
There's so many interesting things and lessons that can be distilled from that. I mean, I think the first is for anybody who's building a community and really reaching out to people and going through experiences together. And some of those experiences may be partying together and it may be doing other things, but branching out, having the poetry nights together, having these adventures together, these hikes together or whatever else you're doing, like you start to cultivate your community. And then once you have that network and those friends and those allies,
you got it.
It's so important because then when you do switch something on, like Daybreaker, they're there.
Yeah.
Like they got you. Like we can't do this alone.
You got it.
You know, it's not just like, oh, I'm going to be in my room and I'm going to get all the algorithms right.
I'm
gonna get my funnel right to get people to go to the thing.
It's like brick by brick.
It starts with your crew. And same with me starting on it. It was like, fuck, like my best friend Bodie, can you give me 60 grand? And, you know, my other friend Howard, can you give me 50 grand? And I got this crazy idea. And, you know,
they believed in you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because they knew you. And I think, again, in this country, we are sold this lie of you must find your perfect profession. You must find the perfect wife. And that needs to be your number one priority. But I really believe that when we actually prioritize community first, professional career and love and relationships will happen from your community, right? And so when we reprioritize that, I really think that we'll end this loneliness epidemic that we're in. We're living in such a hugely funny society that, especially in American society, where it's like ruggedly individualistic, toxically individualistic, and pushing us to sort of find these like individualized career paths and romantic love partnerships. And really, it's the opposite to me. That's true.
And even within the dyads or within the communities, I think there's more that we could go because this absolute individuality, sovereignty, it all, everybody needs to be earning the money. Everybody needs to be, it's completely lost the integrity of the village.
That's right.
Tensegrity, like what actually holds it together was that everybody was doing contributing different things.
You know, there's so many threads to go down this sort of with this path, but there's two pieces of it. There's, you know, there wasn't a word for self in African and tribal indigenous cultures for the longest time. The word, the definition self, is a relatively recent word. And there also isn't a word for loneliness in the Achuar and Sapra tribes of the Amazon rainforest.
Yeah, they don't even use language to endorse the myth of separation.
Because they're connected to the planet.
Exactly. So Tyson Yunkaporta wrote an incredible book called Sand Talk, and he's an Aboriginal Australian, so First Nations Australian. And when he's referring to himself, because he's narrating the book, he uses us too. So like he doesn't even say I,
right.
He says us too.
Yes.
Us too, you know, believe that blah, blah, blah. So it's always just subtly reinforcing that we're not a separate self entity, a skin encapsulated ego split off from everybody else.
That's right.
In rivalrous conflict, counting your fame markers, status markers, money markers, comparing. That's what the ego does. It only knows itself through comparison. So the separate self retracts and cuts itself off from the connection to the field. And if it cuts it off too far, then that's when the separate self becomes the false self because it's living in the delusion that it's actually separate. And then once you're the false self, then all kinds of wickedness can come about. Envy and all of these different other elements come. But when you recognize like, oh, Radha, you're me living a different life.
Yeah.
You know, you kick a soccer ball, I dribble a basketball. Right. You know, you're a girl, I'm a boy. You know, like there's differences.
Right.
But us too.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, you know, there needs to be a beautiful, juicy balance between the me and the we, right? And I do believe that there is a place for our dharmic self to show up in some areas, right? But I think obviously we've gone too far with the kind of cowboy, American cowboy, you know, riding off in the distance by
self-made man.
Right.
I think that's the stupidest statue I've ever seen. Everybody loves it. The man chiseling his own self out of, what the fuck, bro?
I don't get it.
Like,
I
it's a terrible
it.
Model.
Right.
No, like, do it together.
Yes. You know, yes.
Get your homies to help chisel you out of that fucking
That's right.
Iron.
But there's a beautiful healthy opportunity between the me-we, the sort of the we that is the collective. And, you know, in Indian culture, Japanese culture, every chant, you chant for yourself to be saved from desires, saved from, you know, sort of all the suffering. And then you also chant for your community, your sangha, your people, you know? And so, I've been chanting with Soleil, my 5-year-old daughter, recently. We just started. She's just at that age where she can really understand the meaning of chanting. So we've been chanting every morning together, this Japanese Buddhist chant. And it's this wild experience of feeling her understand the kind of herself coming alive, but how we're chanting also for all the animals and all the oceans and all the, you know, the ecosystem. And she loves sort of recognizing that you know, we're chanting not just for ourselves, but for the entire world. It's really special.
Yeah, that's so valuable. I think, you know, when you're a kid, if your parents aren't, you know, uptight and weird, a lot of kids ecstatic dance.
Yes.
I remember, you know, Michael Jackson's, you know, Thriller album came out when when I was a kid.
Me too.
We had a little room.
My first one.
We had a room. So my mom's a black belt in karate. So she had a room. We called it the karate room because that's where she would train. And it was just a carpeted room that was off from the garage. But there was also the place where we'd go play because it was just carpets and open space. And we'd put on Thriller and I would just fucking dance.
Yes.
And kids don't care.
Right.
Until you get to school when other kids start to judge how you're dancing. And then you start to self-reflect and then become self-conscious and then have shame around it. And that can compound. And then people laugh at you dancing. You're like, oh, well, I'm not going to do this. I don't dance anymore. And it just shrinks the soul and the expression, the unique self song of us moving to the music of the cosmos and allowing it to express through our unique vessel. Like that's the magic.
Oh yeah.
But kids get it.
Yes.
And it's like something that I think we should encourage all the way through. Like if I was, you know, dictator of all education, I would be like mandatory ecstatic dance.
Yes.
This is like at least every week, you know, PE is not PE. PE is an ecstatic dance. And also there's the teachers or then the facilitators that if any kids are trying to make fun of other kids or stuff like that, they're like gently being like, no, no, no. Like, this is not how you do it. Like, this is like cultivate that thing. Like everybody get in and just start to explain to them. Like,
I love it.
Be so, so huge.
So we're working on this right now, Aubrey.
Yes.
Yes.
Good.
So basically, well, two things. One, I mean, at Daybreaker, because it's a sober dance party, you know, families come all the time. So we have little kids all the way to great grandmas coming to Daybreaker, right? Because it's just substance free. So that's been really, really cool to witness and begin realizing that, oh, right, sober dance parties means everybody can come. So that's been a really cool byproduct of being a sober experience. And so I'm really proud of that. The second thing that we're working on right now, you'll love this, is with Dr. Dacher Keltner, who's the founder of the Greater Good Science Center out of UC Berkeley. He's a top professor at UC Berkeley on the science of happiness. And we've been working on this proposal for the last year and a half, and we just finally signed the dot, and we're launching a research project this spring that a huge study, the first ever study on the science of collective dance. It's the first time in history that we can actually do facial recognition software to understand pre and post how your face feels and looks, to understand your happiness, right, before and after a dance event. It's the first time we can cheek swab and understand sort of the oxytocin and the different neurochemistry that's released from your saliva. We're doing pre and post survey responses. So it's the first time with the technology available to us that we can actually measure quite specifically the science of collective dance, like what happens when the super organism moves together in unison to music, to the beat of dance and song, and what happens to your cortisol levels, what happens to the overall sort of emotional landscape, right, of the human experience. And when we actually have that study published, our dream is for doctors to begin prescribing collective dance, because right now dance is a redheaded stepchild to the science space because it's not measured and what's
Well, there are a couple studies showing dance improving depression, improving, but that's more in like salsa
you
dancing
got it.
Or
yes,
different things like that.
There isn't anything just in social dance.
Sure.
And so it's very, very cool. And I really believe that the study is going to be groundbreaking because right now doctors prescribe lonely meditations. Of course, I love meditation, but it's still alone.
Best doctors prescribe lonely meditation. Most of them are just prescribing Prozac.
Of course, obviously. So we're happy that we've made some improvements, but it's still all the prescriptions around loneliness and depression, anxiety, and isolation are still more things that you're doing alone. And so now imagine all of a sudden we have a huge study in our hand and we can say, hey, doctors, begin prescribing collective experiences in your city. Go to the YMCA, go to this, go to that. There's so many ways in which we can actually empower your patients to recognize the health benefits of collective movement experiences. It's really, really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's undeniable. I think one of the things, you know, because I've done some research on ecstatic dance as well, and what you're entering into is a state called superfluidity, and superfluidity is flow state.
Yes.
And there's so much research actually that's been done on flow state experience.
Yep.
You know, all of your neurotransmitters, all of your brainwave states, everything changes, your hormone, like it all, the cortisol, everything changes in this state of superfluidity where you collapse this, the music to your movement and to your body, and you just become one with the dance floor, the crowd, the music, everything. It's the same thing that a surfer becomes one with the wave and the board and the spray and the wind, and you, and or the basketball player becomes one with the court and the ball and the you know, players moving, like this super fluidity. It's one of the most healing,
truly
healing experiences we can ever have, and it's just so right there available. And what we have to do is, one, get beyond two of what I think are like the deadly sins, right? So I've been really kind of meditating on like the deadly sins. And of course, this has a big Catholic connotation. So a lot of people probably should, how dare Aubrey, what is Aubrey doing? But I think there are sins, like sins in a way that, not that God is going to come punish you because he's a wrathful deity. Wrath is, of course, one of the sins. And you know, the God that loves us so much. But the sin is, one, it's not having the courage. So like cowardice to me is a sin. Not having the courage to express yourself.
You know what courage comes from? The word?
Tell me.
Courage. It's French. Coeur in French means heart.
Yeah.
So courage is actually derived from having passion, the heart, open to sort of trying new things in service of the heart. So it's wild that—
Of course, lion
Yeah,
heart.
Courage. Yeah, courage is heart-based.
Yeah,
it's wild. Yeah.
So
what are the sins?
There's several, but this one, first one, cowardice, I think is a sin. It's just not having the courage to go through. So a virtue would be courage in that regard. And the other I think they got right is sloth. Like actually it takes energy and effort to get to the magic of the experience, whether it's an ecstatic dance or breath work. Like you can't be lazy.
Yes.
You have to just allow, you have to put in the energy to send it, even sexuality.
Totally.
Like you can, the sin of sloth is, we're a little tired.
Yeah.
But actually once you get started, you're making love.
Yeah.
And once you get started ecstatic dancing and that first drop of sweat starts to go, you're dancing. And once you breathe through that one cycle, you know, where you're really hyperoxygenated and everything is starting to open up, you're there and you're going to keep going. But it takes both. You have to fight against these deadly sins and seductions. One is cowardice and one is sloth, laziness.
I love that frame, actually.
And then actually, if you push through that and become the hero to embody that, both that energy and also that courage, then so much more opens up for you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, dance is one of those things that either you sort of say, oh, I love to dance, or like, oh, I'm not a dancer, oh, I'm shy. And I always say, you know what? Do you walk? Walking is dancing, right? Every single movement that we make as a human being is a dance. And so, I love the idea of be courageous and be energetic and just get out there and just send it. Yeah. And I also feel like, you know, if we can frame dance through the lens of a movement meditation, right? So it's like seeing the meditation of it and how it supports you in a collective, sort of that super organism you called it super flow state.
Super fluidity.
Fluidity, yes. Yeah. So for, you know, the work that, you know, Dr. Dacher Kellner calls it super organism, which is essentially this idea that when we are moving together in this collective clump, right, to the music at a concert or a dance party, your immune system, believe it or not, gets much stronger. Your creativity is actually much more inspired. And your ability to move through traumatic moments or trauma through the healing mirror neurons of seeing other people enjoying themselves, you actually have a much faster rate of recovery around a traumatic experience. And so there's so much science that supports being in this clump together, moving in collective unison. I'll share one more quick anecdote. In 1918 in Japan, the entire country, this is back when they only had radios, imagine every single morning at 6 a.m. and at 8 a.m. on the radio, there was Japanese calisthenics called Radio Taiso, and 6.5 minutes of radio calisthenics that the entire country did. So imagine you have millions of people moving in the exact same way in the entire country twice a day, how that will shift the flow state, this fluidity of that community. I mean, it's no wonder the Japanese are the best technologists, the best, you know, builders and best artists. It's like, sure, there's so much magic to the Japanese culture. And I really, when I looked back and realized that they were moving together in unison as a multi-million person country for, you know, the last 100 years, I mean, it's pretty remarkable.
One of the things that comes to mind when you say that is, so in Muslim cultures, they have the call to prayer and it blares, because we were in Egypt, right? Uh-huh. And it just blares out over the speakers. And it's a reminder that this is the time to pray. And for them, their prayer is their own way, and blessings to their style of prayer and the way that they worship. To me, the one of the ways I want to worship the God that I know in my heart is I want to dance. You know, so like imagining a world where there was a collective call to prayer, but it was a call to dance.
Ugh, I love it.
You know,
I love it.
Like blaring out, like you go into any city center that, you know, they used to have bells that would go off, but instead of bells, it was like
a moment where the whole world dances.
Yeah, this is it. This is like, you know, work gets out, whatever, call it 5 p.m. or 6 p.m. or whenever, or maybe in the morning or whenever this was. Like, it's just like, this is your collective dance break. It's not mandatory. No one's going to arrest you if you don't do it, but it's an invitation yes. for everybody to tune in, you know, broadcast universally. And like, this is your fucking dance break. And then so many, I could just imagine like the best DJs in the world, if this was a nationwide thing or fucking even a worldwide thing, became like its own religion, you'd get the best of the best. Like today, 20-minute set from fucking
exactly
Tiesto, yes. whoever, it doesn't matter, Daft Punk.
Yeah, I have a dream, Aubrey. And I, you know, for maybe everyone listening, if you can make this happen, my dream is for us to do a global dance party from outer space, where there's one song basically that we choose from every single country. So let's say there's 150, 170 countries. So there's one song from every country, and the entire globe dances together for peace and dances together for unity and dances together for this pale blue dot. And, you know, I really feel like we're right there. There's an opportunity to do this type of celebratory kind of ritualized experience where instead of it just being one artists for the whole world, maybe it's one song from every single culture that mm-hmm. we figure out which one will feel the best or that represents the country mm-hmm. and then do this like outer space global dance party where the entire world is. You think we can make that happen?
I mean, that vision is an important vision to hold, because the world where that happens is the world we want to live in.
Yes.
Right? So yes. like, We're drawing a timeline from our world to that world. And I've talked to Emily Fletcher about this too, of having an erotic, universally erotic experience in this way. And it's like, yes. And the world that would accept that and like understand that this is a moment to tap into your own internal eros and your own pleasure reserves, in the way, which is another way to pray, you know, and sorry, religious people, but this is another way to pray.
It is.
Like, these things are part of the more beautiful world. And this is the world we're trying to build. And there's obviously a lot of forces that are seemingly pushing the world in a different direction. And it's a contest, which world is going to be the outcome, or is the world going to split? And there's going to be some people that do, but I love this idea of the whole world being able to come together and dance, almost like, and you could even tie it in with like, you know, the Olympics are going to be in
France.
Exactly,
I was just going to say World Cup or Olympics.
Yeah, it would be like, all right, this is the world ecstatic dance to kick off the Olympics.
Right.
You know,
challenge accepted, let's go.
I have so many thoughts about the Olympics too. Like, I feel like instead of all of the
competition,
the war, like competition is great. In the Olympics, Like, we're competitors, totally. We're athletes, and that's the beautiful part of competition. But then it can get toxic with right. the comparative competition or the bellicose, you know, war competition, which right. is obviously the most traumatic experience and crazy that it's still going on at the consciousness that we're in. It's heartbreaking. But so to be able to celebrate the competition, but also dance together where all the athletes and everybody, it's just a huge dance party. I mean, I do like the opening ceremony. It's very beautiful and whatever. But if it was also
global, entire world dancing together. Yeah,
you set off that thing with a dance party, and then you close with the dance party where you forget which nation you're from. You forget which colors you're wearing. It's just everybody's just dancing together. And then you divide off into your separate nations, your separate tribes, your separate athletes.
Like, all right, good luck.
Now we'll see you.
Now we're in competition.
Now we'll see you on the field. Exactly. I'm coming for your ass.
Exactly. I love that. It feels obviously like that's what sportsmanship should look like. It's why you shake hands before and after a game, you know? I love that Emily is thinking about this. I love that we're all kind of in this world visioning of just like, what is the world we want to live in, you know, and where, you know, where does the technology of dance belong in the future? It's the ancient future, mm-hmm. right? And so it really is kind of bringing this ancient kind of original technology for human celebration and again, moving through trauma, moving through sort of moments of ecstasy from the past into the future. And I think it's one of the few things, the few kind of movement practices that we are still, we're just wiggling our bodies. I mean, that's really what it is. Yep. Like I call it, I want to write a book called Wiggle that's just about just wiggling your body mm-hmm. and the benefits of it and all the ways in which we can wiggle our bodies to move to creativity, move to ecstasy, move to joy, move to, you know, move to forgiveness, move to, there's like a million ways to wiggle.
No doubt.
Right.
No doubt. You've been planning other trips too. You know, what you're doing with the wow, it's now kind of thing. You have some, not only this Egypt adventure, but you've done some other adventures. You went to Antarctica, right?
Yeah.
And you've got some other different Africa.
Yeah, we did the Serengeti. We missed you. And we're doing the Arctic this summer. You're obviously invited with Vi. June solstice, summer solstice.
So cool.
Yeah.
And what do you distill from also the medicine of traveling to these places? Because this is also something that I think is underrated. And of course, deepest compassion to those people who don't have the funds to travel. But there's so many amazing places, even in the United States, to travel.
Yeah, I feel like this
idea of traveling, prioritizing that, go somewhere wild and cool with your friends, or go totally alone and make new friends. That's also another fucking big deal.
Totally. During COVID, I had this sort of, I did this Joe Dispenza week-long meditation down in Baja, Mexico. And it was mm-hmm. the first time I gave myself 7 days to meditate for 12 hours a day, you know?
Yeah, he goes hard.
He goes deep. He goes deep. Yeah, he goes hard, goes deep. And morning and night, and it was just like nonstop. And I just remember kind of, you know, sort of being wowed by this time that I gave to myself to just meditate for 7 days and just give myself the opportunity to go really deep within the spiritual realm, within my own mind, my own body, the spiritual realm through my breath work and et cetera. And in that experience of just going deep, I was able to tap in. I think, you know, in this world that we're so overly busy and overly technologized, right? Everything, there's so much noise. But when you actually shut the noise down and you just allow your mind to just listen, all of a sudden, Gaia came to me and she just said, wow, it's now. Wow, it's now. Wow, it's now. And I remember being like, whoa, this is like a beautiful phrase, like this wow, the magic, the celebration of the wow, and then the solemn and the depth and the gravitas of the now. And I was like, wow, there's so much juice in this rhyme scheme. It's so fun. It's so playful. It's so childlike, but it's also so deep. Mm-hmm. All the juice, right? And so I wrote it down on my notebook a million times that week. And then I was like, I'm a community builder. I'm an experienced designer. You know, I'm a new mother. What can I do with this phrase? Is it a conference on on Mother Earth? Is it a festival? You know, what is it? And then all of a sudden I realize, wait, maybe this can be a way to design experiences in the most tender parts of the planet, where we bring the most influential voices, the most interesting sort of tapestry of humans to these tender parts of the planet and give them a once-in-a-lifetime experience, mm-hmm. and change their relationship to that part of the world forever and see what comes of it. Mm-hmm. And Antarctica was our first stop, and we, you know, we took 150 people to Antarctica right during, just at the end of COVID. We had to charter our own plane from Orlando and flew to Ushuaia. It was a whole thing to get to the Antarctica waters. But we figured it out. We got there, and what ensued was just like, we had DJs and we had founders and we had high net worth investors and we had philanthropists and we had environmental scientists all in the boat together. And when you spend 11 days with this type of high octane group, what's going to come out of it is insane magic. So we raised hundreds of thousands of dollars for climate nonprofits. Then we raised millions of dollars for climate startups, one of which is my twin sister, Mickey's startup, Hero Technologies, which is all about, plastic eating mushrooms.
And that's, by the way, we just said plastic eating mushrooms. Like, people are going to be like, it's a whole thing. It's not our thing. But basically, there's certain types of fungi that can actually start to break down all of these plastics and microplastics, which are littering the whole fucking world. So this is a big deal.
Yes.
It's a new technology that's coming out. So people worried about plastics, stay tuned.
Yeah. And so we raised, and then we had 17 companies pledged to go carbon negative, which is really cool. So then we're like, all right, this is kind of working. Let's do Egypt. So then we did Egypt, which you and Vi came to, and it was amazing. And you brought your posse, and it was so much fun, and it was beautiful, and it was deep. And I had some of the most profound revelations in Egypt. I'm still processing. Anyway, that's a whole story for another day.
And I got, just on a personal level, I got to see you as a leader in that, and I got to see how much you cared and how much you loved everybody and really listened. And, I just want to send my admiration to you and like deep respect, because there was a moment, obviously it was a packed trip, a lot of big ceremonies and activations. And at the end, people were a little frazzled and there was some tension, and you just brought everybody together and you listened and you just kind of held it all together. And it was just like a beautiful moment to see how you would respond underneath mm-hmm. that kind Thank of pressure you. And the strain of everything, and just to see you shine through with your heart forward, courage. Like, it was just your heart that was up there.
Thank you, Aubrey. It's hard to lead. It's intimidating to lead 150 founder type, type A, high octane humans. But I just, again, leaned into the feminine, and I just was like, all right, I'm just gonna stay open to, the feedback and all of that.
Yeah. And I loved your sister just coming in like, you don't even know, this is my sister, blood of my blood. I love how you guys love and support each other too.
She's the best. I really do feel lucky to have a twin who just, you kind of like from the womb to the tomb is our adage. It's like we were born in the womb together and we're gonna go to the tomb together. And it's like a beautiful little quote that we have together. Yeah.
So sweet.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's like all of this, and then we went to the Serengeti to really connect to the Great Migration and now we're going to the Arctic Circle to really commune with the indigenous, really actually thinking about the eagle and condor prophecy, which is a really special prophecy where the indigenous shamans of the South meet the indigenous shamans of the North for the first time, opening up this whole new moment for humanity. And I didn't even know about this until Josh Barber told me about this this prophecy of the eagle and condor. But I just said, I want to bring the indigenous people of the Amazon to meet with the indigenous people of the Arctic and have them meet and connect. And I want to do all kinds of spiritual activations on summer solstice. Matthias is coming. And, you know, we really want to just bring forward the next kind of chemistry of how we're going to save our planet, and mm-hmm. having the Amazonian tribal leaders meet and connect and commune with, you know, basically the Amazon being the lungs of the planet, meeting the blood of the planet, the water, the ice, you know, the blood of the planet, to have those two indigenous tribes meeting for the very first time, not on neutral ground in Washington, D.C., or some Hilton hotel for some, you know, kind of environmental conference, but actually no one's ever taken the money and time and energy to just, actually, I was just like, I'm going to fly, I'm going to pay for all of it, for you to come to the Arctic. And these indigenous tribal guys, you know, were just like, wait, what? This is amazing. And so we're taking them for the very first time to meet the ice. And these are guys that walk barefoot in the Amazon, you know, these are guys that don't wear shoes. And to bring them to the Amazon rainforest to sit and actually, and we're going to have this incredible salon learning with translators, what are the ways in which they all think about the planet? How are they healing the planet? What is the medicine that they can, that we can, 1 + 1 = 11 together?
At the intersection.
Yeah. And so I'm really excited to continue shifting and evolving the Wow It's Now experiences. It was an expedition and now we're calling it a pilgrimage. And I'm really excited to kind of evolve and continue evolving the ethos of our experiences beyond just fundraising for all these incredible nonprofits. To also make it a pilgrimage and make it a spiritual experience and make it sort of an opening for this new moment in history.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited about that.
All right. So we got several types of medicine to recap. One, the medicine of ecstatic dance.
Yes.
Super important. Two, the medicine of travel. Three.
Yes.
The medicine of what happens when different medicine lineages intersect.
Yep.
You know, that's three. It's another one. And then four, which I want to go deeper on now, is the medicine of community as the antidote to loneliness, which is the paramount epidemic of our time. You know, it is the deadliest epidemic that we've ever faced. You know, Vivek Murthy, it's worse, you know, being lonely is worse for your health as far as longevity than smoking a pack of cigarettes a day.
Like, I was just connected to Vivek yesterday, actually, on an email. I'm excited to meet him and connect with him. But yeah. What we're doing is, I mean, what he's doing is, you know, on the epidemic of loneliness is obviously from that level of Surgeon General is so big. I'm so proud that he's recognizing as a doctor. And by the way, doctors don't talk or learn about sort of emotional loneliness, isolation in medical school. It's like not even,
yeah, despite, he learned that. Despite the fact that it's the number one predictor of
exactly,
all-cause mortality.
Exactly, every disease,
yeah.
Yes, and lifespan, you know. I mean, I'll share that having poor social connections is as harmful to your physical health as being an alcoholic and twice as harmful as smoking cigarettes, right? And when you are lonely, your productivity mutes, your cellular sort of regeneration goes down, like all of it just diminishes and your lifespan declines by an order of magnitude. So there's all kinds of physical reasons why loneliness is actually hurting our country. It's the first time actually in history that Americans are, their lifespan is lower than it was in the last decade.
And it's, you
know? And it's really stems from loneliness.
And it's surprising because we're more connected than ever. And it's not, and this is where the deeper understanding of loneliness has to come in. It's not actually how many people you're around. You know, like there's no doubt that, you know, someone like Robin Williams was probably surrounded by people all the time. But to make the decision to kill himself, and again, I'm not in Robin Williams' mind and I'm not going to diagnose why, but I do know that in the feeling that you're seen truly and loved and held by the people around you, like that decision just evaporates out of the way. Like you can be lonely in a crowd. You know, you can be putting on the smile of a clown or you're the avatar of your personality, but deep in the interior of your own mind and heart, you feel alone. So loneliness is not about how many people you're around. It's about how deeply you're connected.
That's right.
Those fuck yeah friends, like who do you know is like really going to be there for you?
No, yeah, I mean, one in four Americans have zero friends to confide in. And this number has tripled in the last 30 years. One in four Americans have zero friends to confide in it's a wild statistic, right? And you know, it's when I think of why, I think of there's, you know, basically all of the institutions are actually pushing us towards isolation. Think about it. Governments are pushing us to political polarization, right? Healthcare systems are treating us as disposable, right? Health, education systems are doing testing and competition. So, you know, every single, the financial systems are pushing us the more materialistic culture so that we can buy more stuff. And have that hockey stick growth, right? News media wants us to be polarizing to sell more papers. I mean, literally every input that we're experiencing as a human species from the foundational structures are pushing us towards toxic individualism. Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, one of the things that we have to look at is how can we actually restructure all of these systems to be in service of belonging and connection and meaningful relationships.
When are the times that you still feel lonely?
All the time, Aubrey. You know, I think it's hard in marriage, you know. I think in marriages when you have a child, for example. My husband and I, for example, had a child 5 years ago, and I think for the first 3 years, you know, everyone probably listening knows this as well. It's a game of logistics. You move from like, want to go for a sexy date night to like, who's getting the diapers? Like, who's getting lunch? Who's packing? It all becomes a game of logistics and you're no longer in that juicy intimacy state. So there's been many moments where I'd wake up or go to sleep just feeling deeply lonely in my marriage because I just felt like we had forgotten the intimacy of our relationship. We were just stuck in the logistics of parenting. So that, I would say, was the deepest, most painful experience I've had of loneliness in the recent years because you know, this is the person that you're the closest to. It's, you know, it's the person that you love the most. And yet we sort of forget and we're so exhausted by the end of the day. And, you know, so there's all this stuff. So I think that, you know, I think it's a very natural experience for anyone who's a first time parent to feel that level of loneliness. I actually also felt that my body was changing when I was in pregnancy mode. My body was hormonal. I was growing a baby inside my body. Eli wasn't changing. So in that moment, I was like, wow, I'm so hormonal. I just need more. And he couldn't read my mind. And mm-hmm. I was like, you know, and so I started, instead of actually complaining or being upset, I started a community on WhatsApp called Modern Mamas. And that's what I do. I'm a community builder. So I was like, all right, let me build a community of moms who are also running businesses so I can really understand how they're managing both being a mom and running a business. And so I called it Modern Mamas, and I invited, you know, 12 women that I knew I wasn't close to, but I knew that were moms and doing that type of work and at a high level and high performing women. And all of a sudden now there's like 100 some women on this WhatsApp thread, and it's the most active WhatsApp thread I have. Every time a new mom comes on, they're like, I have mastitis, my daughter's this, my son is this, like they're scratching and pulling in school. Like, and literally there's 100 women that respond immediately. And it's just the most unbelievable group of mothers who are so there for strangers they've never met. It's basically 100 women that sort of have met maybe like in passing, or many of them they're all over the country now, but it's this community of moms that have come together. So I'm sharing that because these moments of loneliness that we have can be fleeting if we don't wallow in that loneliness, right? It's like, how can we be solutions-based humans and citizens? And I think that's the biggest issue with loneliness. There's two pieces of loneliness. I think one is our embarrassment and humiliation to admit that we're lonely. There's a lot of shame around loneliness. I'm good. I'm a big man. I'm Aubrey Marcus. Oh, I'm, you know, like, I don't need nobody, you know, like that's how we were taught as a society. Like, you're a big man. Like, you don't need, you know, you're good. And I think that's like what, you know, that's why when you share, I'm lonely or I'm struggling, you're giving so many hundreds of thousands of million people who are listening to this the ability to be vulnerable too. And so I think step one is admitting your loneliness. That's the first, to normalize that every single one of us feel lonely, including a community builder like me who has a million friends and has spent a lot of years of my life, you know, building my friendships, you know, so that's why I have a lot of friends. And still now I'm, you know, friends moving away here and there, they're still like, oh, like, where are my friends at? You know, so there's definitely lots of moments like that too, right? And so step one is admitting your loneliness, that I am lonely. I'm not ashamed to say it, to normalize it. Step two is recognizing that meaningful relationships, building that, taking the time, the way you go to the gym, you have a beautiful body, you go to the gym, you pump iron, you eat healthy food. I know you really take care of yourself. I just went to your pantry just now before sitting in here, you know, and if we can actually place meaningful relationships in the same, that's my goal, in the same category as fitness and nutrition, meaningful relationships, fitness and nutrition, that is a holistic life. That is a holistic health practice. And so that's the second thing, is to recognize that. So the first is admitting that you're lonely. The second is making sure that you see meaningful relationships and cultivating meaningful relationships in the same way you go to the gym and eat healthy. The third is to not wait for an invitation. I think so many of us are like, when are they gonna be, am I gonna be invited to the wedding or this party or this Saturday night or whatever? What I love about you and Vi is you're always creating the festival, the event, the experience, the sound bath, the all the things, this podcast, like the on it, all the things that you it's always you guys create. That's why you have friends for life, because you're making the invitation. You are taking the effort to create experiences that invite amazing people that are attracted to the things that you're putting out. And so do not wait for an invitation. Put out a thing in the world. Give it a name. Dim sum. One of this, I'm teaching a community building masterclass right now. It's a 6-week course. One of these girls, she calls it Dim Sum X. And I'm like, what is it? It was like, she's like launching a community called Dim Sum X. And she came to my class to like figure out how to build this community. And I was like, what is Dim Sum X? And she said, oh, it's like TEDx, but with dim sum. And I was like, I love it. I want to come.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so it's just like, anybody can create anything. I love dim sum. I actually really do. And I love learning. So I want to go to an event like that. That's cool. And so you can literally create anything out of anything, doesn't matter what, but don't wait for an invitation. Make an event that's fun, that's creative, that's interesting. Give it a fun name. Go on ChatGPT and Dolly, make your little poster in 30 seconds. Dim Sum X Learning. I can make a beautiful dim sum poster, and boom, you're off to the races. It's done. And so I just think that we're living, you talked about lethargy or one of the sins, a sloth. You're just waiting to be invited, waiting. You don't want to go on the dance floor. You don't want to go in the bedroom, whatever. Same thing with community building. It has to be a courageous, energetic experience. It's exactly the same. And it starts with yourself. So I put together this whole new rubric I call the Compass of Belonging.
Yeah, which, I'd love for you to share that.
Yeah, which you know, this is new. This is hot off the presses. You know, I spent the last 6 years researching and understanding our sense of belonging through the lens of a community architect, right? Like, I'm a community, so I'm always thinking through the lens of how can I build community? How can I scale community in the right intentional way? But then doing all of this sort of work and going and meeting with the Maasai tribes, the indigenous tribes in Achuar and Tsapa tribes, the Amazon rainforest, and just all these different places, I realized, wait a minute, belonging starts with yourself. Of course. But not just kind of, oh, Radha, I belong to myself. But it's like, actually, how can we reconnect to these four directions? So I call it the compass of belonging. So there's four directions, the north, the south, the east, and the west. The north and the compass of belonging is your spiritual connection. It's how to reconnect to the spiritual realm. We know 10% decline in religiosity year over year. You know, churches are losing their members 10% year over year over year. But how can we create a non-religious but spiritual experience where people can go to these places to trust fall into these beautiful realms where your brain and your body get to just trust fall into this beautiful, juicier realm of spirit, you know? And actually, there's all this study that shows that when you, right after an ecstatic experience, your parietal lobe in your brain is activated. This parietal lobe is all about the self, and it disappears, and it sort of allows you to sort of begin seeing yourself not as a self anymore, but as a much larger kind of universal entity. And so there's this beautiful experience when you hit the spiritual realm of what it does to your brain and your chemistry, of just like allowing your body, your cortisol levels to reduce because, hey, the spirit's got me. I'm good.
Yeah.
So that's the north. And then the south is our connection to the earth. And not just like our connection to the earth through the lens of what's our carbon footprint, the masculine numbers game of just like, you know, how are we reducing our footprint? What is the recycling numbers? What is the all the numbers and arithmetic added to the conversation of regeneration and planetary conservation? But it's an energetic reconnection. How do we belong to the energy of Gaia? How do we, you know, reconnect to the sort of the energy body of her Mother Earth, you know? And so that's, we can do that through forest bathing, Shinrin Yoku. We can do that through, you know, through connections with surfing. You talk about all the different sports that are available to us. Yeah, how do we reconnect in an energetic way to the planet is so important. And then behind us is our lineage. It's the west direction, where we come from, where the sun is setting. Did you know that behind you, there's 2,064 people in just 10 generations that it took to get to you? So if it's you, your parents 2, your grandparents 4, your great-grandparents 8, 16, 32, 64, you know, et cetera, in just 10 generations, it's 2,064 people that it took to get to Aubrey Marcus. Is that wild? Think about that. I mean, imagine in 20 generations, it's thousands and thousands and thousands. So all of a sudden you realize the miracle of you, and you're like, I'm not alone. I'm not lonely. Yeah. I got my peeps. I got my ancestors. I got spirit. I got planet. I'm Gucci, you know?
Yeah.
And then in front of you, the East, right, is your service. And you know, another wild stat, did you know that only 10% of Americans volunteer every year, 1 hour of their time to volunteerism? 90% of Americans do not volunteer one single hour of their time. I mean, it's a sad statistic.
Indeed.
We're living this toxic individualistic culture that we're just looking out for ourselves.
Yeah. Well, if you don't love.
And then we feel lonely because of it.
Yeah. If you don't love people enough and you don't see them in the fully realness that you see yourself, then why would you volunteer? Because you don't really care. They're just another separate self that they're going to take care of themselves just as you're taking care of yourself, and everybody's all on their own.
That's right.
And so, yeah, but finding your own unique way
to serve,
to do it. Like, cause we all have our own unique medicine.
Yes.
So yeah, it's, you know, sure, you can go to a soup kitchen or do something like that, but that is ultimately something, it's a function that a lot of people could do, and maybe that's not your unique medicine, but maybe it is. Maybe as you serve the soup, just the way you smile at somebody could be the unique transmission, or it could be something radically different.
Like mentorship.
However, even how the attention that you put into the art that you create. I mean, art is a form of form of service. And this is another thing, like, I really appreciate the cities that paid attention to like the art installations and like the ways that things are beautiful. It means so much. You know, you go by something beautiful and you're like, whoa, that's fucking cool. And it makes a difference. Like somebody like Daniel Popper, who makes those unbelievable statues. We have one on our farm that's just like these wild megalithic statues. They're in Tulum. It's the woman in Tulum with like pulling her heart open, right? Like that, him working on that, knowing that that's going to be an installation somewhere, that's an act of service.
Yeah.
That's like another way to do it. So we don't have to say like, oh, community service, oh. Well, first of all, there's an incredible bliss, the bliss of really being of service, but being in your unique service with your unique gifts, your unique voice, your unique medicine that you're able to share, that's where you really start to get this infinity loop of giving and receiving, what the Quechua people would call Aini. The reciprocity starts to flow in just unbelievable ways.
You got it. I mean, it could be simple as like my family for the last 7 years, and this is one of the things that we do, but like, every year for the last 7 years, we go Christmas caroling at my parents' elder kind of golf course community in Florida. It's like kind of a retirement community. And we just go door to door and we knock on the door and we'll do this for 2 hours. And it's like my Indian dad and my Japanese mom and my Jewish family members and my sisters and I was singing Christmas carols, like, you know, and we knock on the door and we wish you a Merry Christmas and we're singing all these songs. And it's just a joyful way to serve and volunteer, yeah, just kind of joy, you know, in the time of the month when so many of these retirement, you know, women have lost their husbands or they're alone, you know, on the holidays. And so, yeah, it could be as simple as that, you know. It doesn't have to be something that's like feels exhausting to you. Although there's just joy in all of it, garbage pickups, soup kitchens, all of that too.
And just also being aware when somebody crosses your path.
Yes.
That you can just take a little bit more time and be of service to them in that's a right. way. You know, like I'm always listening. That was really my mom's philosophy is that, you know, you're not going to be able to help every animal. You're not going to be able to help every person. But there's going to be some that cross your path. And if that's they right. cross your path, then it's your invitation to help them out. Whether it was, you know, it was the story of a wounded hawk that we had to go help and rehabilitate right. or a wounded deer or a person who's just hurting in some way. Or a person who maybe is not even hurting, but just a little bit of your time, you know, is like just taking that attention. I was in the airport recently and, you know, this woman comes up to me and she'd obviously listened to some podcasts and she was really like excited to, and just, I wasn't hurrying to my flight, you know, but it was like tight. Normally I would have just gone and made sure I got all my waters and all, you know, all the things sorted, but just kind of stayed and just talked to her for a little bit. And like finding those, because I don't know why that moment came about, but maybe that moment had an impact and it felt like there was like something cool that I was able to transmit in
beautiful.
That 4 minutes I spent in the airport it. Instead of just saying, okay, yeah, thanks, you know, back on my way.
Right. No, that's exactly it. Like there's a Buddhist, in Mahayana Buddhism, there's something called Ichinen Sansen, it's Japanese, which literally translates to in every moment, you have 3,000 options to choose from. Which option will you choose? Will you choose to be unkind, rude, unforgiving? Would you choose to be loving, generous? Like there's 3,000 options for every moment. And that's a beautiful kind of Buddhist saying and prayer around just sort of how you want to live your life. And I love that. It's like in that moment you could have walked by or you could have just been like, no, not now, leave me alone, or you could sit and talk to her. So you chose out of the 3,000 options to take the time to speak to her and connect with her. And mm-hmm. it's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. And so expanding this vision of what your almost your philanthropy is, right?
Like, that's right.
And it's also, you know, people, oh, I give this money to charity. Well, okay, that's great. It's right. important. You know, it's important to do all of those acts. But what's your, how are you getting
yes,
it?
What are your so you unique really gifts? Yeah. Yes, yes. What is your value? You know, it's so fun to actually do that. It's so fun to be like, oh, I get to share this, or I get to, you know, one of my girlfriends, she's really great at bringing, like making lighting everywhere really nice, you know? So like she'll bring a bag of like tea candles and electric candles everywhere she goes and little uplights. So if she goes somewhere and it's like overhead lighting, it's not uh-huh. a vibe, she'll turn everything off and just like put tea candles everywhere. And she doesn't have to do that, but she just does that from the bottom of her heart, you know, just to be like someone that contributes to the kind of the juice and the energy of the space. And I love that, right? I talk about that all the time. It's in my book, you know, and it's just like that. One of my friends, he's an amazing masseuse, massage therapist. So at any one of our parties, he just literally walks around and just giving everyone a 5-minute sure. massage, and it's just a shoulder rub, and it's beautiful. You're an amazing masseuse as well. I received an 8-minute from you. Yeah, I'm still waiting
mini,
for the full
little mini.
Yeah. But
little amuse-bouche.
Amuse-bouche, exactly. But you know, what are your gifts and how can you contribute them to a space? And instead of waiting for the host to impress you and looking for shit to be upset about, to walk into any space and ask yourself, how can I add value? If this is not hitting my mark, well, what can I do? Can I change the music? Can I change the lighting? Can I massage people? Can I offer, you know, better conversation? There's so many ways in which you can make an event or an experience so much more inspiring just through the service of just through wanting to serve the experience, mm-hmm. right? Like if you show up somewhere, it's like, thank God Aubrey's here. Because I know whenever Aubrey's here, it's going to be epic or it's going to be a value addition here.
Yeah. Like you know? adding your ingredient to the stew is only going to make the stew better.
Yeah.
And then there's the other way. If you're in your own bitterness and your own self-loathing and your own pain, you're going to actually poison the soup to a certain extent. You know, like in the collective, you'll be draining the energy. And it could be something as simple as that person at a dinner who's just like on their phone and not paying attention. It's just kind of like a vacuum that's slowly sucking the energy from the eros of that particular moment. So it could be subtle or it could be actually like pushing out negative energy. So there's the antithesis of that service and that support to the collective as well that we have to be mindful of.
That's right. It's like, and people often ask, well, why did I get invited back? You know, why don't I have any friends? And it's because you complained or you're constant, there's this consistent sort of judginess about the way you show up at an event. And it's either you show up in service or you show up in criticism. Like, what's it going to be?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, those who are in service will never feel lonely, right? Mm-hmm. There's actually a lot of science around this too, of just those in service are happier and more grateful. Your energy is actually more expansive. You attract more good positive energy around you when you're in service. And the opposite is true for those who are, again, looking to criticize an experience or just wait for the host to impress you,
mm-hmm.
right? You know those people.
Of course.
Yeah.
This is one of the, again, I love that idea that there's 3,000 choices that we can make. And I really believe that. I'm a firm proponent. I believe the truth of this in my body, that we do have free will.
That's right.
And we can make a choice. And there are contesting forces. But there's always a choice that it may not be an easy choice and you may need help, but there's always a choice
that
you can make. And there's the better of the options. Sometimes all the options aren't that great, but you could choose the best and choose to move through it in the best way possible. And just to remind people of that agency and the power that we have to be in some way, like people place shamans in this category of like, oh, okay, that's a shaman. Well, what does a shaman do? A shaman affects collective energy. They affect collective energy.
Mm.
And can anybody not affect collective energy? When you make a group
that's
laugh,
right.
are
that's
you
right.
not being a shaman that's actually changing the collective energy of the space? Of course you are. Like, we're all energetic shamans in this extent. And that doesn't diminish like what an actual shamanic maestro can do. Obviously their capabilities and their magic is astounding. But to understand that we're all able to affect the collective energy. And then once you understand that, with that, you can have pride in that responsibility and be like, okay, I can make this environment either greater or I can diminish this environment. And that goes for social environments too. Like, what are you posting on people's posts? What things are you offering?
I really don't understand troll culture. Do you?
Yeah, I mean, I understand it. I understand it. I think it's, it goes back to another of the deadly sins, which is envy.
Mm.
It's envy. It's they are actually feeling pain at somebody else experiencing something that they feel is unavailable to them.
Mm.
So if you're expressing yourself freely, it's like, let's take dance for the example. Right, so somebody is dancing just freely and wildly and moving their body, and somebody else feels locked and constricted and like that's not available for them. And so they have a choice. One, they could have the courage to actually move beyond their constriction and move forward and experience the same thing, or they could try to tear that thing down. And it's the envy, that the deadliest of the seven deadly sins, I would say, the envy that causes people to want to reduce somebody to the position that they're in. The old saying, misery loves company. It's like, if I'm miserable, I want everybody to be miserable with me. And there's an interesting flip between envy and sadism, because, and I've also been, I just wrote a newsletter about this actually as well. But so envy is pain experienced from someone else's pleasure, right? That's envy. Like it's, I'm somehow feeling worse because this person is feeling better in some way. So pain from someone else's pleasure. The inverse of that is
pleasure from someone's pain.
Someone's pain.
Yikes. Yeah.
And so those two things are two sides of the same very dark coin. And you can see how easily it flips. I actually watched The Princess Bride again last night. Fucking so unbelievable. And in that, Humperdinck talks to Buck. So in the story, Humperdinck is this tyrannical prince who's just trying to create this false flag and kill Buttercup and give cause for him to go to war with Flanders. And he's just this maniacal, you know, maniacal character, right? But also is kind of in his own charming, maniacal way. And he recognizes that Buttercup, who has true love with Wesley, who's the hero, Buttercup and Wesley are the heroes of the story. He realizes, okay, you know, Buttercup has true love with Wesley. They share this thing, true love. And he feels like that is unavailable to him because he does not have love in his heart and he does not have access to it. So as soon as he discovers that, he goes to where he's imprisoned, Wesley, in the pit of despair. And he says, I'm going to actually pull out my phone and read this quote because it exactly like exemplifies what, so he says, he goes to Wesley, who's tied up to this torture device after just talking to his bride to be, who he's going to kill. And he says to Wesley, "You truly love each other. And so you might have been truly happy. Not one couple in a century has that chance, no matter what the storybooks say. And so I think no man in a century will suffer as greatly as you will." So wow. That was the point where envy turns to sadism. And then he turns the torture device to maximum and tortures Wesley with 50 years of pain in 10 seconds, right? Because he envied the fact that love was available for him. And then he turned to sadism, the desire, you know, this feeling of getting pleasure from that person's pain. And I think all of these attacks on people's art and their expression is envy turning into sadism. Mm. So they lash out to try and hurt them because it feels good to them. And it's all based on this envy, sadism inversion.
Uh-huh. And I think the envy comes in many ways from loneliness.
Sure.
You know, I think so much of that envy is like, I don't belong in these spaces.
Somehow you're cut off from
love. I'm cut off from, you know, oh, Aubrey gets to go to these types of amazing spaces and I don't. Or I feel lonely because I am not invited into these spaces. And so I think there's, and yet, you know, I wrote a book called Belong. And yet, you know, you can't invite everyone to everything, right? And so how can you create belonging and boundaries at the same time? So that's like the real dance, right? So when you know, I've been told by a few people, you know, former friends, who would say, "You wrote a book called Belong, but I don't feel belonging with you," you know, and to that, I'm like, I'm so sorry. I haven't spent enough time with you. How can I make it up to you? You know, and so I found that so much of that pain comes from either feeling unworthy, ignored, uninvited, and ultimately lonely, right? Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, you know, envy and loneliness, are they connected?
Mm-hmm. I think in many ways, because, and in some ways, it is the thing that you feel like you can't have, you know, like, so anything that you feel like you can't have that somebody else can have. So if you're lonely, there's a lot of things that you feel like you can't have. Any connective experience that somebody else has, you want to kind of tear that down. So I experienced that in the community that I've built, Fit for Service, right? It's like, it's such a powerful, you know, engine that creates community and yes. belonging and is like the hell banishing, you know, antidote to loneliness.
Right.
People really feel seen.
Yes.
Share your
exactly.
triumphs and your traumas and your challenges, and you get to know and see and walk with each other. And then people from the outside who really actually would want to have that same feeling, like we're showing in the videos of people loving each other and dancing ecstatically and moving through breath. I know it's going to be incredible.
Like, I feel like there's so much
connection. We got to cross that. Yeah. But so if you can't have it, well, they're going to tear it down. Oh, this is some cult. Oh, look at Aubrey Marcus's sex cult or whatever. I'm like, you know, like, okay, I understand. Like you really want somebody, you know, you really want to feel loved and seen, and you're going to put whatever kind of projection you can imagine to try and tear this down and right. make it seem like it's not real. But it's really just coming from envy that you want it, that you just really want to have that hug, and you want to have right. someone look into your eyes and say, like, I see you.
I know it's, and how do we, and what, and in your mind, you know, I have so many antidotes for loneliness. What is your antidote for envy?
The Buddhists say that envy is the hardest emotion to actually transmute. So from an alchemical perspective, it's the hardest emotion to transmute. And so I've always, you know, I remembered when I heard that, I was like, that's interesting. And their strategy, so I'm going to take this a couple different ways to answer this. One, in the process of alchemizing this emotion, they say you have to move from envy to anger. And then from anger, you can then alchemize anger into other emotions and move to a positive state. But actually, envy itself is stuck. So you have to go to another place that's still not healthy, but is actually able to be worked with.
Right.
Because envy is so poisonous that if you're stuck in envy, you actually have to move it to something else. So you have to like allow yourself to feel the rage that's underneath all of that. The rage at the universe, rage at the person, whatever it is, but you have to move it that way. Now, of course, I don't think that's the ultimate solution. That's more of like the transmutable,
right.
natural, like a way that we can be alchemists and wizards in a way to kind of move it. But I think fundamentally the antidote is you have to be able to recognize that person that you're envious of is you living a different life. So how do you do that? I think you have to go through some doorway where you have an experience of the field, a true self experience, when the true self being the total number of true selves in the universe is one, right? Like there's the sum total of conscious minds in the universe is one, like this idea of unicity. You have to merge with the unicity to then be able to recognize
your win's my win.
Your win is my win.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a deep spiritual process. It's the ultimate antidote to envy. But in the moment, you might have to just move it around to alchemize it. But fundamentally, to get to that state where you can go from envy to compersion, where you're celebrating another person's win, you know, like that requires like being able to see somebody as another version of you.
Yourself, yes. I love that. The seventh chakra, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that unity center. No, I love it. I think it's all so connected, you know? Mm-hmm. I think of envy as it relates to our sense of loneliness, you know, I do feel like it's societal. I do feel like societies can be envious of other societies.
Of course.
That creates this institution of loneliness. So it's a really interesting, you know, I haven't thought of the concept of envy through the lens of loneliness. I mean, I'm going to spend a lot of time thinking about this when unpacking it.
Yeah. I think all of these things are kind of woven, and we start to understand the connections. We start to get maps, like your beautiful map using the directions, you know, north to spirit, south to the earth, you know, west to our ancestors, east to our service.
Yes.
You know, like it's a beautiful map, and like having some of these maps to kind of guide us through, you know, there's so many different. It's almost like we need new planetary software, because the software
That's right.
we're running, like our hardware is fine, but the software we're running on our hardware is it's malware. Like we got a lot right. of we got a lot of bad code right. and we need to debug this fucking totally. Software. We're in the rainbow wheel of death right now and right. it's just like things are not really working out. And this is communal, it's also parental. You know, I had an experience recently in a psychedelic journey where I connected with my father who passed last year. And, you know, it's not the first time I've connected to him, but it was a really beautiful experience where, and it's a longer story, but, you know, there was some part of it where he was saying like, I'm sorry, son. And, you know, like, and we were just sharing love. And at the end of it, he said, son, I've given you my best and you're better than I ever was. And it makes me so proud. You're better than I ever was. And I think that's also like a code for parents to be like, my son, my daughter, I'm going to give you my best, but you will be better than I ever was. You'll be better than I ever was because I'm going to give you my best and you're going to take that and you're going to make it even better. And like that transmission and to just know, like, don't worry, like, I'm going to give you all my best and you're going to be better than I ever was. And just to celebrate that.
Wow. Yeah, that really hits home for me, Aubrey. And over New Year's, I did my first Aya ever just a few months ago. And I've been waiting for the right invitation, you know, for 20 years, actually. I've just been like, no, until finally I got the invitation to go and sit in the Amazon with the Achuar and the Sapra tribes, with Lynn Twist, the founder of the Pachamama Alliance. And I went and sat, and it was like the most... And I'm still, of course, it takes months and months to process. I mean, it continues to unfold all of the lessons and all the downloads. But for me, my daughter came to me so clearly. My 5-year-old daughter, she just was like, literally like in my face. And she just said, Mommy, you know, you and Daddy together, you and Daddy really finding that loving connection and kind of your dharmic path with where Daddy holds the keys to your consciousness upgrade. I can't do my work. I can't do what I came here to do on this planet because I came here to do some big shit. And I can't do it unless you and Daddy really understand the consciousness upgrade that you offer each other.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was this big aha moment for me of just like, wow, the medicine is so deep. It's so, so wild. And yeah. And so I've been really kind of following her instructions ever since for the last, you know, 3 months.
That's beautiful.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah. That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And it was beautiful to see you and Eli here. Here today. And to continue to see you guys and, you know, and just, it's a beautiful honor and a pleasure to know you as a friend and know you as a sister and just celebrate the amazing work that you've been doing and that you'll continue to do.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Please, people, go to the Daybreaker event, experience this. And, you know, we've given all kinds of different pathways to medicine. And we need all the pathways. This world is getting crazier and crazier, and we gotta show up and we gotta send it.
You know, we just launched our new nonprofit Belong Center, which you also helped to sponsor. So thank you. And we're doing a whole series of yellow benches, circular yellow benches, instead of, you know, benches that just face forward and you're not talking to each other, you know, but we're putting circular benches all over. We had, you know, multiple calls with Central Park and, you know, parks and streets and city spaces all over Denver and Austin. And so our dream is to put these yellow circular Belong benches all over the country. And this nonprofit is really kind of building a 2.0 community center to end loneliness. Like, our mission is to end loneliness and build a culture of belonging for all. And we have so many different projects that we're working on that I'm excited to continue sharing with you. Yeah, it's a, you know, Daybreaker is sort of, if you love to dance, come to the dance party. And if you're feeling lonely and you feel like, where are my people at? You know, Belong Center is, you know, the whole point of it is to matchmake you with the right values aligned communities. So that's our dream as well, is to really matchmake every human so that they're never lonely.
Mm-hmm.
starting with yourself, you know?
Yeah. I think there's so much that could be done with that too. And I think a lot of really cool restaurants have like communal tables.
Yes.
And like this idea of like being able to eat together and like being in some, you know, I guess some, I know that's not always going to be what you're going to want to do, but in the right environment, those are some of the coolest experiences where you just get to cross paths and meet somebody and give it a chance.
Right.
You know, like one of the, my favorite expressions is, you know, give God a chance, give God a chance to weave you in contact with the right people. And it just means keeping your eyes and your heart open, just looking around, seeing what's available there. And maybe you find yourself on a circular yellow bench and maybe you just ask a question, you know, like a real, how are you doing?
That's right. We're going to put a QR code on this yellow bench that you can scan and it'll have literally, you know, 100 different questions.
That's so cool.
So you can sort of pull it up and like, if you want to fall in love, if you want to rupture and repair with someone, if you want to make a new friend, you met a random person, you can just scan it and like, you know, find the list of questions based on what the type of conversation is. And I'm really excited to launch this project. It's our first kind of public event project all over the nation.
Yeah. Can you drop the URLs for people to find or Instagram handles?
It's daybreaker.com and belongcenter.org. And then our community building masterclass is at belonginstitute.com.
Yeah. And if you're interested in building a community, Rada's a good choice to teach that masterclass because you're a master at doing it. And I love you, sis.
I love you. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, of course. And we love you guys and we'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning into this podcast with Rada. Make sure you check out Daybreaker and Belong Center and all the amazing things she's up to in the world. We love you guys and we'll see you next week.